del 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 del.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to Radio Rumi, episode 66. This is your host, Fatimeh Keshavarz, professor of Persian and director of Roshan Institute for Persian Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. This is a very special summer episode. After a delay in our communication with each other, I have been busy with summer projects, and as I told you at the beginning of the summer, there will be sporadic episodes during the summer, and then we will go back to our regular episodes when the semester begins and we are back to university in August. For this episode, I must thank Farhang Foundation, which is an Iranian studies foundation focused on culture and literature, located in California, and they do work with Santa Barbara University to get these episodes out. They invited me to speak about Persian literature, particularly classical Persian literature, and the way the producers of these words, poetry and prose, were aware of the world. Were they citizens of the world? How much did they know about the world, and how much they cared about the others who were not exactly like them, people who had different religions or lived in different countries. For this episode, I focused on Aziz Nasafi, Sa'di of Shiraz, and of course on Rumi. I will not say any more, as when you listen to the podcast, you will know what I am saying about them and why do I consider them worldly thinkers. People who care about not just their own people and their own culture, but what happened elsewhere in the world. I call this episode, "For the lands and the seas are vast, and the people in it are numerous." It's a translation of a line of Sa'di, "Ke bar o bahr farakh ast o adami." Again, beyond thanking Farhang Foundation for giving me the sound file for this presentation that I made for them to share with you, I would like to thank John Mullen, my colleague who will put some of his summertime into sending this podcast out to you. I hope you are all enjoying your summer, wherever in the world you are, and I look forward to getting back together in our regular Radio Rumi podcasts. Till then, be well, and I look forward to speaking with you very soon again. Goodbye.
Greetings and Durud. I welcome you to this latest edition of our Iranian Studies Initiative lectures in collaboration with the University of California, Santa Barbara. I am Alireza Ardakani, Executive Director of Farhang Foundation here in Los Angeles. We are a 100% member-supported, non-political, non-religious, not-for-profit organization with the sole mission to celebrate Iranian art and culture for the benefit of the community at large. Today, we are delighted to welcome Professor Fatemeh Keshavarz from the University of Maryland for today's talk titled, "For the Seas and the Lands Are Vast and the People Numerous." This series is made possible with the support of the American Institute for Iranian Studies, the Persian Heritage Foundation, the California Humanities, and the Gharamian Emrani Foundation. Now it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Farshad Somboldel, the Middle East Studies Collection Strategist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, to say a few words.
Thank you so much, Rezajan. Welcome everyone, welcome to our continuing lecture series on Persian and Iranian literature as world literature. Our speakers this year examine a variety of issues such as the recognition of classical Persian literature in global literary canons, translation and reception of modern Persian literature into European and Middle Eastern languages, decolonization of Iranian literature, Iranian women's literature in the 21st century, and the ethnic diversity of Iranian literature. I'm delighted to introduce our speaker today, Professor Fatemeh Keshavarz. But Professor Keshavarz completed her studies in Shiraz University and University of London. She taught at Washington University in St. Louis for over 20 years, while she chaired the Department of Asian and Near Eastern Languages from 2004 to 2011. In 2012, Professor Keshavarz joined the University of Maryland as the Roshan Institute Chair in Persian Language and Literature and Director of the Roshan Institute Center for Persian Studies. Professor Keshavarz is the author of award-winning books, including Reading Mystical Lyric, The Case of Jalaluddin Rumi, Reciting the Name of the Red Rose, Lyrics of Life, Sadi on Love, and a book of literary analysis and social commentary titled Jasmine and Stars, Reading More Than Lolita in Tehran. In addition to her impressive academic career, Professor Keshavarz is also a talented poet, having published works in both Persian and English. Her poetry reflects her deep understanding and appreciation of Persian literature and culture, as well as her own unique voice as a writer. Her poetry has been praised for its lyrical beauty, its profound insight into the human experience, and its ability to bridge cultural divides. So without further ado, Professor Keshavarz, this virtual podium is all yours. Thank you.
Greetings, everyone. And thank you so much, Dr. Somboldel, for introducing me so kindly and graciously. Thank you to University of Santa Barbara and to Farhang Foundation for giving me this opportunity to speak about a topic which I really hold dear. And now I would have a chance to share it with friends and colleagues in this group. The idea of this talk came with a conversation about whether Persian literature, and in particular classical Persian literature, could be viewed as world literature. This is an interesting question, and one that I think we would do well to pay attention to, because it is a big question to see who reads this, who the poet writes for, and where does these sets of words go to reach its audience. Of course, when you look at the classical Persian literature, it's a vast ocean. And so in order to be able to bring this topic under control a little bit in a short presentation, I have selected three major writers. And one thing about, and I will introduce them briefly, but the difference between them is that they write in different genres, or at least the genres that I pick to focus on are very different from one another. They all come from a particular period, namely the 13th century. I will tell you why I'm going to that century. And I would look at their personal experience of the world, their connection with and understanding of the world, their actual physical travels and references to the other with capital O, that is, the group of people who we always consider not being like us. Examples of their comments is very important because the world that they come into contact with is a very special world. And it's important to know how tolerant they could be of this other who speaks different languages, you know, lives in different parts of the world, believes in different belief systems, and so on and so forth. So in a way, we're looking at their social tolerance for social diversity, if you like, if you want to use the modern lingo. But it's also to know who read their work. So we look at all of these. The first person is a Sufi philosopher, physician, Aziz ad-Din Nasafi, born in the city of Nasaf or Nakhshab, to geographically describe it, it goes beyond the river Oxus that we in Persian refer to as Amu Darya. And the place in English would be referred to as Transoxania, beyond Oxus. Sometimes it's referred to as Mawara'un-Nahr. And the Iranians, actually Persian writers, sometimes refer to it as Fararud, the space that goes beyond the river Oxus. Now, for you to get a better sense of what this place is, not so much on a piece of paper on a map, but what you have actually heard about, that the cities of Samarkand and Bukhara fit in this area. And we all know that Khale Hinduyash Bakhsham Samarkand and Bukhara, which Hafez refers to, tells us how these parts of the world were valued culturally, aesthetically, and in many, many different ways. Nasafi, as you will see very soon, has done a lot, but what really caught my attention when I came into contact with his writing was that he sees the whole existence, all of the cosmos, as a manifestation of one light. Now, this is easy to say, but actually to be able to think about the entire world with all of its differences and conflicts and so on as being the same manifestation of one light really stood out to me. And interestingly enough, he's almost unknown among Persian speakers, even those who are interested in the culture of Iran, they still don't seem to be really knowing his work in any possible depth. You can look him up in Encyclopedia Iranica. There's a very beautiful article about him, but that's about it, really, not much more. Then I will go from Nasafi. And I should have said this. He is born early in the 13th century and dies almost towards the end of the 13th century, so 1200 something. And then from him, I go to Sa'di of Shiraz, born in Shiraz in 1210. And I didn't give you that date for Aziz Nasafi because we don't know it. Sa'di is a very interesting character, as many of you already know. He, at very early age, young age, travels to Baghdad. And as a youth, he studies there and becomes a teacher in the Nizamiya of Baghdad, which is a huge honor. Particularly for a non-Arab speaker and for someone who's that young. And Sa'di's many things, an ethicist, a master Ghazal writer, a humorist, an avid traveler, and a lover par excellence. I'm really going to emphasize that because I think the kind of views we see from him are very much rooted as being this avid lover. Be jahan khurram az aunam ke jahan khurram az o. I'm glad to be in the world because being and the world are glad by him, with capital H. I am in love with the world because the whole world belongs to him. So again, we're hearing this whole world, and you will see that it is not just a
you know, a phrase, a general expression, but he really speaks of the world. And then in the second line, and I want to highlight this because we're going to come back to it, به غنیمت شماره دوست دم عیسی صبح. به غنیمت شماره دوست دم عیسی صبح تا دل مرده مگر زنده کنی که دم از اوست. Cherish every morning breeze, the breath of Jesus. Oh, the breath of Jesus, we know, is life-giving with the Lazarus and all of that. Cherish every morning breeze, the breath of Jesus. Let the heart come to life, for this breath belongs to him, the morning breeze. So from that early stage in his writing, he is speaking of the world with this kind of language. You know, of course, we can, with master writers like Sa'di, like Dante, like Hafez, you can pick various aspects of their lives and say, oh, Sa'di wrote some ghazals in praise of this king. But then, you know, you have to really go and study all of that in detail to see what did he say in there or what other works did he produce. So I'm holding on to the lover side and connecting it with his worldview. Better known than Nasafi, but still not really a very well-known figure in English-speaking world. So one point I'm making here is that our realization that this literature is world literature should give us the incentive to make use of it in multiple ways, not just as, you know, exotic pieces of art that are so beautiful that we want to just keep it in a book in the corner of our bookshelves. And that, of course, falls much more on us and as teachers and educators, but something that goes through my mind. And then from there, of course, I'm going to Jalaluddin Rumi, Maulana, if you're in Iran, Mevlana, if you're in Turkey, Rumi, if you are in England. And, you know, is the first thing you think is he doesn't really need that much introduction. But there's so much we don't know about his real life, including the fact that he wasn't born in Balkh. We call him Balkhi, but he actually was born in the city of Vakhsh, very near the river Vakhshab, in present-day Afghanistan, of course, and not very far from the city of Balkh, about a couple of hundred miles south of Balkh. A poet, a scholar, a mystic, and he traveled hundreds of miles with his family from Balkh because they were living in Balkh later. To pass through mega cities such as Baghdad and Nishapur and Samarkand, and before they finally reached the present-day Turkey, the present-day central Anatolia the city of Konya or Konya, as we call it today. Now, I sometimes jokingly tell my students, Rumi is really the immigrant par excellence because he comes with a new language, although of course Konya is much more multilingual than we realize, but the language of literature is Persian, the language of religion is Arabic, and the majority of the general public speak Turkish. So, and actually there are also Greek speakers around. So he is there, with a whole new universe. Now we will examine his perception of the other with capital O and this different and familiar, sometimes politically hostile. And now it's a good time to tell you why the 13th century is so important for this particular concept of how people thought, conceptualize the other, because there were a whole array of hostile others who were doing all kinds of very unpleasant things to everyone. No shortage of others with capital O. The Mongols, nomads from Central Asia, they were coming all the way from the east, moving towards the west, a lot of killing and pillaging and, you know, and all that came with war. And in the west, we have the Crusaders, very violent. I don't know how much we actually know about the violence of the Crusaders, but if you, there is a book that I would recommend if anyone is interested in that called The Crusade Through the Arab Eyes. And it just because Arabs were subjected to them much more, you could actually read about some of the stuff that happened in the wake of the Crusaders. And of course, at all times, all during this 13th century, and before and after, we have the Greeks next door, and they could easily turn into, the relationships could turn into hostility and things that would make us feel there was another other with capital O there. Now I have to give just a quick caveat is that I am not suggesting that these three people were the only travelers among the Persian poets. You already know that. Khaghani, Nasser Khosrow, Fakhreddin Iraqi, Sa'ib Tabrizi, Abdurrahman Jam. I can just go on with the poets who traveled and traveled intentionally to learn, to explore, to see new things. But we, of course, don't have time in this short presentation to go through that. I also, my second part of my caveat is that this is not a sociological study. And it doesn't intend to be that. In other words, I am not giving us a statement about how these societies functioned and reacted to everything. There was no violence, or everyone was kind of bona fide, any of these poets were bona fide feminists and, you know, activists for diversity. No. That kind of study requires much more careful disciplinary historical exploration. When you cut a piece of time, which we call historicization, and open it up with details and then read and study and go from more than the source of poetry, obviously. So with these caveats in mind, you may ask me, well, what are you trying to tell us then if you're not saying these things? I guess one thing I'm hoping will come across is that these writers lived in places that compared many other places in the cosmopolitan world, but they could write world literature because they could think outside the box. Whatever was what the general public's misunderstanding could be, they could move past it. They could look beyond it. And that gave them the opportunity to open a whole new window into the world for their readers. Nasafi, to go now to what their own ways of thinking, is always speaking of humanity. Not the people of Nasaf, not the people of Iran, not the people of, not the Muslims, not God-fearing people, but actually people of the world. A dervish. در باطن و ظاهر آدمی خزاین بسیار است. هر عضوی از اعضای آدمی اندرونی و بیرونی خزینه است. So in one of his writings, which is philosophical about what life is about, he begins with, oh, my humble listener, he always calls people a dervish, because I think he wants them to be thinking of him as such. He's not there you know, on a pulpit, giving them, telling them what's right and what's wrong, but he wants to be one of them. And so he calls them a darvish. My humble listener, in human beings, internal and external limbs, because they believe that we have internal body parts as well, perception and, you know, lots of other psychological tools and so on. In these human beings, these internal and external limbs, there are numerous treasures. Indeed, each part of us is a treasure house by itself. So to begin with, he's starting to give us a whole different view of humanity than in many other parts of that the world at the time would be seen. We are not born sinful. We are not of lower value. And I'm not criticizing those views. Those views existed and of course have their own critics and they had their own believers. But he starts with, you know, it's not about us being at a low level and having to pull ourselves up. It's about humanity understanding how high it sits and value it and put it to good use. So he goes on to say, these treasures are immune to loss, which means no matter how much you spend of them, they remain untouched. So you are encouraged to use these treasures that are at your disposal. And then he wants to say, okay, he knows that people are going to say, well, how do you know that? You know, you're saying this thing, but what, how do you say? And his response is, these professional skills, the works of art, the glorious buildings, all the knowledge and wisdom in the world come from the treasures that humans in these places have at their disposal. Again, everywhere in the world, if you see these beautiful buildings, if you see scientists, if you say see great poets, recognize that they all have the same treasure. How sad that some leave their treasures, he says, unused and spend their lives jealous of the treasures of others. So recognize your value and go on to put it to good use. And then he always touches on these what we call these days, you know, hot button issues. And of course, one of these hot button issues are paradise and hell, you know. So he speaks about them. You know, he says, بدان عزك الله فدارین که حقیقت بهشت موافقت است و حقیقت دوزخ مخالفت است. This to me is an absolute treasure. No, my friend, may God grant you respect in both worlds, that the reality of paradise is peace with each other. And the true hell is strife against one another. You may hear this expressed in different manners, he says, but its meaning is the same. Now that you know the truth of heaven and hell, know that each of these places have multiple doors, because they were always talking about the seven doors of heaven, seven doors of hell, you know, on pulpits when people were preaching and so forth, and when they were writing books. So he's giving us his doors to paradise, kind words, gentle behavior, and good manners are among the doors to heaven. Ugly temper and unkind words are the doors to hell. Now, this is a serious practitioner. He is not just saying anything goes. And I don't want to give that impression. There are certain things that are serious, you know, values for him that he follows. He talks about praying, he talks about fasting, he talks about not overeating, you know, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, peace with others becomes the value, the door that gets you to paradise. And actually, I don't want us to go into too much detail here because we're, you know, losing time on others, but it divides people to Ahle Shariat, Ahle Hikmat, and Ahle Wahdat. Those Ahle Shariat are those who try to follow the appearance of the law and hoping that that will get them to paradise. Ahle Hikmat are people who try to understand the riddle of existence through rationality. And the Ahle Wahdat are the people of unity. And even though he doesn't say where he stands, Ahle Wahdat are the people he is rooting for. And, you know, we know that beyond doubt. And of course, knowing what he has just said, then we're not surprised. So then he says, what do these Ahle Wahdat, the people of unity, say about life? They say the Ba'atinain, they say that know that the people of unity say that all existence is but one light. Ahle Wahdat میگویند که باطن این وجود یک نور است و همه نور است که جان عالم است و عالم مالا مال این نور است. The people of unity say that the inner dimensions of existence is a light. This light is the life of the world. Again, not the Muslim world, the world. Indeed, the world is brimming with this light. And you might say, okay, Mr. Nasafi, where do I fit in this cosmology? Light, God, everything's immersed in light. Well, what am I there? And he gives the answer, which is not easy, through a metaphor, which makes it easy. افراد موجودات به یک بار مظاهر این نورند. The creatures are all manifestations of this light. هر یک دریچه اند و صفات این نور از این دریچه ها بیرون تافته است. So they're each a window and this light can shine through them. In other words, it is us, human beings, and the rest of existence who allow this light to come into manifestation. Now, then he goes on to say, these windows get old, they get new ones come forward, some go to dust, some are smaller, some are larger, and some come before the other one. But these windows are not superior or inferior to each other. Their relation with one another, and I think this metaphor is an absolute masterpiece. Their relation of these people who are all windows through which the light comes, but they're different windows. So why are, if there's some old and some new and some large and some small, why are they equal? Because they are like the letters of the alphabet in a sentence. It doesn't matter which word, he says, was written first, which word last, which word is larger, which word smaller. Even if you take an and out of a sentence, that sentence does not produce meaning, correct meaning anymore. So we are the literature that is the world, and everything is expressed through us. And what should we do? به این نور باید رسیدن. این نور را می باید دیدن. And here's the key sentence. و از این نور در عالم نگاه می باید کرد. Get to this light, recognize this light, but most importantly, see the world through this light. And that's the only way you can overcome those kinds of differences and seeing the others are bad, yourself is good, and so on and so forth. Now, Nasafi's works were valued and read in cities like Bukhara and Samarkand and Nishapur when he crossed the Oxus River, which he did more than once. One time early in life, he just came in search of a teacher, and later on he had to run away from pillaging armies of some conqueror, and he crossed the Oxus River again and came to Iran, and this time he went to Isfahan and Shiraz and Abarqu, and he tells you where he wrote these pieces because he values the people there. Now, as you can tell, I wish we could talk about Nasafi for the rest of this talk, but I really want to open new windows using his metaphor. And let us look at Sa'di of Shiraz, whom I described as the lover par excellence. Now, I'm going to tell you that I don't mean that this love is only spiritual either. It is being as a human being, sensual as well as a spiritual, getting the world, embracing the world, and being in love with it. Listen to this. یکم شبی که در آغوش شاهد شکرم گرم چو عود بر آتش نهد غم نخورم. به بعد یک نفس ای آسمان دریچه صبح بر آفتاب که امشب خوش است با قمرم. ندانم این شب قدر است یا ستاره روز، توی برابر من یا خیال در نظرم. بدین دو دیده که امشب تو را همی بینم، دریغ باشد فردا که دیگری نگرم. میان ما به جز این پیرهن نخواهد ماند، وگر حجاب شود تا به دامنش بدرم. Tonight that my sweetheart is holding me tight. If they burn me like aloe wood, I don't feel nothing but delight. I would feel nothing. Forget that double negative. That's not how it translates. I feel nothing but delight. Tonight, my moon and I are ecstatic being together. Tell the heavens to close their doors on sunlight. Has the star of dawn risen? Is this really you? Or are my eyes deceiving me? Perhaps this is the night of power. The luckiest and the most blessed of nights. With these two eyes that are looking at you this very moment, tell me, how do I ever contemplate any other sight? Now there's nothing between us except this garment. If it keeps us apart, I will tear it open with love's joyful might. So this lover was actually a very seasoned traveler. For a few decades, almost some say 30 years, we're not really 100% sure, but he spoke of going from the West to Africa, East to China. And he wrote about these travels. But again, I don't think we should take everything he said as facts, because he said, very tongue-in-cheek, in Golestan, that Jahan dide besyar guyad durugh. So if you have traveled the world, you might joke about something. You might make up something because it makes it just more delightful and more desirable. Now, Sa'di is so well known for what is written on the entrance to the United Nations, that really that says it all about what he thinks of this world, which he loved dearly, spoke of its good and bad and so on, everything. But that, as you know, is Bani Adam Azal Yek Peykarand. And, you know, I don't read it Yek Digar because these two are two separate readings, and I go for Peykar, which I think it fits with the poem more effectively. بنی آدم اعضای یک پیکرند که در آفرینش ز یک گوهرند، چو عضوی به درد آورد روزگار دگر عذرها را نماند قرار تو که از مهنت دیگران بیغمی نشاید که نامت نهند آدمی. Human beings are all limbs on one body, for they were created from the same essence. Now, please bear in mind, this is a time in which even the creation of man and woman are questioned as two different sets of acts by God, one good and one not so good, in many parts of the world. You know, and I'm talking about not just people like Aristotle, I'm talking about Thomas Aquinas and many other thinkers from other traditions. And in this world, he sees the entire humanity of the same essence. And the important part, when one limb is suffering from pain, no other part can rest. So if you are indifferent to the pain of others, you do not belong to the human family. So again, I don't want to present him as a feminist in the sense that we know today in the social environment in which we live. He lived in a society where women could not even leave home by themselves. So however, nonetheless, what is important is that he sees them as all people, including men and women, on same existential grounding. And then I want to end the reference to him with this poem that this worldly person, he didn't travel because he was afraid of something. He didn't travel because he couldn't come back to his country. He really was fascinated by learning from the world. And he gives that to us in a story that he says from in the Bustan, one of his major compositions, about a scholar who came from the Oman Sea. از دریا یا عمان بر آمد کسی سفر کرده دریا و هامون بسی عرب دیده و ترک و تاجیک و روم ز هر جنس در نفس پاکش علوم. So he didn't call them Berbers or barbers or wild or Arab and Turk and Tajik and Rum, including the Greeks. They all had knowledge to learn from. جهان گشته و دانش اندوخته سفر کرده و صحبت آموخته به شهری در آمد دریا کنار بزرگی در آن ناحیت شهریان. Unfortunately, we can't read the story, but let me just give you the English because I want you to, for those who may not be English, Persian speakers, to follow all the details. From the Sea of Oman, there came a man much troubled by ocean and desert. Arabs he had seen, and Turks, Persians, and Greeks. From every race, his pure soul had learned a science. World traveled, wisdom he had amassed. Traveled, he had learned manners and sociability. Now on Rumi, that you all know pretty well, I'm not going to take more than a short, maybe 3 to 5 minutes at most, but I want to refer to one particular thing that is at the core of everything he tells us, and that is the language of the heart. No other language matters, because this language goes beyond rationality, beyond nationality, beyond language, beyond everything. همزبانی خیشی و پیوندی است. مرد با نامحرمان چون بندی است. ای بسا هندو و ترک همزبان، ای بسا دو ترک چون بیگانگان. To speak the same language is to share the same blood, to be related to one another. To live with strangers is the life of captivity. But who is that stranger? Many are Hindus and Turks who share the same language. Many are Turks who may be alien to one another. The stranger is the one who doesn't speak the language of mahrami, companionship. پس زبان محرمی خود دیگر است. همدلی از همزبانی بهتر است. غیر نطق و غیر ایما و سجل صد هزاران ترجمان خیزد ز دل. The language of companionship is a unique one. To reach someone through the heart is other than reaching them through words. Besides words, allusions, and arguments, the heart knows 100,000 ways to speak. Now, that makes us understand how, when he sat in the courtyard of his school and spoke, hundreds of people gathered there to listen to him because they were touched by this language that wasn't tried to be flowery and very learned, but it was the language of the heart. And actually, he says, some people feel so safe in these gatherings that they fall asleep. And he says, if anybody slept here, don't wake him up, don't bother them. That is because you are like people traveling on a dangerous road, in a caravan, you're afraid of what might happen to you. And when you hear the barking of the dog and the crowing of the cock, of the rooster, you know that you're near a village and you feel safe and you can fall asleep. My voice is the barking of the dog of the village of safety. That is why Persian speakers across the world, right now, that we think there are things we have to learn how to deal with, what we do to our environment. Is science going to answer all our questions? Our search for security, that these kinds of ability to speak to each other is most essential, and Persian literature gives it to the world that can read it. At the same time, Rumi will tell you that in alam bar misal kuh hast. Harche bang koni az kuh haman sada shenavi. Don't think this will all happen to you free and easy. It is your actions that make it possible. Whatever you say to the mountain, it echoes back to you. That particular song. And so the last word I would like to end on is that, and that the divine, whatever you think it is, aftabast bar hamegan mitabat, is the sun and it shines on all. Why some would take it less than others? They wear too many layers. Bari jam sabaktar kun ta zawq aftab babini. Wear fewer layers of attachment, of fear, of guilt, of anger, so that you can feel this sunlight. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Professor Keshavarz. That was a great, great talk. I learned a lot and I took a lot of notes. I may come back to you later with all my questions after this session.
Please do.
First of all,
to the extent that I can, I'll be delighted.
Well, I want to thank everyone who left us comments here and questions. There are a lot of questions and also comments for you all. Make sure that we will send you all those later on. But before I start the questions from audience, I want to take advantage of my position and ask the first one myself. So, your observations about the underutilization of classical Persian literature and regarding it as archival objects actually is very well taken. In light of this, what concrete steps can be taken to increase the recognition and inclusion of Persian literature as a part of the world literary canon, not just like some archival objects, museum objects that we can have, as you mentioned, on the shelves, like some kind of nice literary heritage. And I don't just mean within the departments of Persian studies, but rather in other disciplines, in world literary forums, literary circles, festivals, we don't have that much presence. And I want to also mention the contemporary literature as well, because especially post-1990s literary activists, poets, writers, they don't have that kind of significant presence either. I see this even more critical. And also, like at the end, I wanted to ask, what kind of challenges do you see throughout this process?
I think challenges are, part of the challenges are the challenges that all of in humanities, the field of humanities faces. Fewer, you know, dollars available, few less support. Well, as we see with the example right now with Farhang Foundation and many other places like this, the Iranians are now, have been stepping forward to do things that would get this voice out. And my recommendation would be, and I'm not saying that we should give up on university. I think we should insist on departments of world literature, having people in there about Persian and Turkish and Arabic and all these parts that haven't really been recognized. But I think that when we celebrate these among ourselves in gatherings like this, it is very important that we get the voice out to non-Persian speakers to make it into topics that make sense. I mean, Rumi has been an amazing opening for us, but to do things to just basically get people in. I think we should also encourage talented non-Iranian or second and third generation who are at home with literature of the country they live in to do Persian and become translators, scholars, and so on. Because as we speak from the fish, you know, swimming in the river, they could speak from the one standing on the bridge looking at, and that would be fascinating and wonderful. So, I think there are, the efforts should be going at the same time as it goes in the academia and in the community. I think the activity of translation should be valued. Until very recently, faculty could not get tenure based on their wonderful translations because it wasn't considered original work. But what is more original, you know? So, pushing for having these done and then encouraging our young people to value it, to recognize it. And, you know, they discover it, they love it. So, you know, there are multiple ways and they will themselves become ambassadors. And I wholeheartedly support your comment about modern Persian literature. I mean, I can read and talk about Furu forever and Simin and you know, Behbahani and others. It's just, they're just treasure houses.
Yes, of course. And also, like, I wanted to acknowledge the literary activists within the field. Actually, many poets and writers actually are working as academics right now, and right. We probably need more support from the authorities of the fields, like yourself. As you mentioned translation, this leads us to one of the questions asking about why do you think you mentioned Rumi as a very good start point, actually, and translations of Rumi actually available. The question is, why do you think Rumi received by the Westerners better than anyone else? What kind of attributes do you see in the reception of Rumi in the West?
You know, I think that, again, it's a question with multiple dimensions, answer with multiple dimensions. First of all, he is really contagious. you know, while you talk about various poets and it gets to Rumi, the response that comes from the students is different. And he means it. He means to be reaching. He says, Altesham. Garzan nata yadzin sohan, pishtar al das and arman bezan. I'm fine. If you know, come here and you can feel it. So there is that contagiousness, which comes from the language is not overly complicated. It's not pretentious. It comes from the heart. And of course, he's a master poet because he breaks multiple rules and he's still writing the best kind of poetry. So partly is that. The message is a message of universal, you know, peace and connection, love, but also the fact that people got really impacted by it, even from the time of Nicholson and afterwards others. You know, there are people who write about Rumi and say, I had a strayed from my religion and he got me back to my Christian religion. You know, so they feel at home with him, the same kind of safety that he talks about. But also the fact that there are many people who are critical of the translations of Coleman Barks. And, you know, when I want to work on a talk or something, I translate myself because, you know, we get fussy if this is your field. But I think the fact that Coleman Barks is a poet, the fact that he really fell in love with Rumi through the works of another master, Shbawa Mohyeddin, whom he sat in his presence, and Baba told him to translate Rumi. So there was a connection there, sometimes too strong a connection, I feel, that pushed him there. And then what he produced suddenly became very accessible to ordinary English speakers here in the US. But of course, the same thing happened in Russia, you know? The socialist communist Russia was looking for, who is this Rumi who's teaching people things we don't want to at some point, because Russians were reading the translation. So it's partly him, partly his message, partly his language, and partly historical opportunities that make something available.
Thank you so much. We have a lot of questions. I apologize. Everyone.
If I may use this opportunity and make a little self-promotion, okay. I actually have a podcast called Radio Rumi. So I'm calling it Radio Rumi precisely for what we were saying. I want people to know this is not a kind of me sitting there and analyzing the complexities of the, no, it's about what comes to you from the poetry. And so that's, you know, you can just Google it. And I discuss various issues that are standard questions that people have. So I'm happy to answer anything I can and fits in the time. But basically what I mean is that is also exactly for that purpose.
Yeah, thank you. Well, actually, these kind of activities are what I believe are one of the most important ways of us getting out these discussions about literary in Persian literary canal outside of the academia.
Exactly. And
actually promoted that way. Well, thank you so much. I need to rephrase some of the questions because I don't think we have time to go through all of them. One of the questions is that from Mr. Faramars. How do you analyze the tolerance and acceptance of the others by Rumi, especially women and believers of other religions? So he actually quotes and mentions instances from Rumi where he calls them like Kamju of Yatalab, Asir Nafs, or downgrades women. How do you analyze that?
The people who study Rumi and they downgrade women? Is that
Rumi himself, Rumi's
okay.
point of view.
So that is the point. I'm so glad this came up because the last thing I want to really say is that Rumi is a bona fide feminist in the way that we these days define it. Imagine women were never allowed to, for example, leave house without company. they wouldn't work outside. Many of them wouldn't have the opportunity to be educated. So they were socially not at the level that men were. I mean, there was no comparison. The reason that, and then he has in the Masnavi when he gives examples, because these examples, these beliefs are generally are spread among his readers, he uses these examples because they understand it. It makes sense to them. If he would say, well, women right now are the most powerful people in our society, they would just be laughing at it. He would talk about them as not knowing as much as men. But the stories in the Masnavi often have women who correct the mistakes of the men. Despite the fact that he starts at the beginning, when the woman comes across as not knowing enough, in the end, the woman is the one who corrects the man. Not only that, in his social life, there are some things we know. He has a letter. He writes to his son about not being kind to his wife. So he tells him off. And he says, you're not allowed to do this. This is not acceptable. There is another incident. He's walking on the street in Konya, and women prostitutes had to wear certain outfits or shoes that would show who they were, what their professions were. And obviously it was a very painful thing. And one of them stops to ask Rumi a question. So Rumi stops, talks, answers. And then when he's leaving, he expresses the same reverence and respect that he would express to anyone. And this becomes an issue that how could you respect this woman? And so it is definitely a matter that he wants to be publicly seen, that no matter how much he would disagree with someone or something, that does not give people the opportunity, the justification. So we know these things, and at the same time, we have to accept that, yes, they would talk sometimes about women as creatures who talk too much but don't think enough, or if they give you an advice, don't listen. But Rumi's always, one characteristic of his Masnavi is that he starts a line of thought, it's his voice, and then one of the characters comes and subverts that line of thought. And then somebody else comes and disagrees with that. So it's all about allowing oneself to realize this diversity, the rightness and wrongness is nobody's property. And so in that environment, what he's seeing as definitely existentially, women are not viewed as inferior.
Thank you. Another question from Kurosh. They mentioned the very interesting metaphor that you used, actually mentioned from Nasafi, considering us like people as a window, small or large, letting the light in and out. The question is that, can this view be considered an equivalent concept of subject or suje, as we use in Persian literary criticism and theories, and as it becomes so important to the modern West, so can we consider that this concept, this metaphor, as the idea of subject, human as subject?
The human subject. Oh no. Well, of course, the idea of human subject is so complex, and it changes at different times. And with modernity, the subject finds different rights and definitions and roles and so on. So going into that it's a whole new, conversation. What I would say is that because he tells us about the difference in the size of these windows, their oldness, the material they're made from, and all that, he recognizes difference. But all of that difference, so there is difference between them. So in some ways, there's some level of subjecthood, is given to these windows. But he's very quick to tell us that the relationship between them is like the relationship between words in a sentence. You can't say one of them is more important, because if you pull any of the words out, that destroys the meaning. So I think it could be the beginning of a conversation about that, but it's always trying to jump from the literary observations. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, but it's very tricky into the social studies area, because you have to have a much wider range of material. You must be able to look at them, compare them, isolate them, and things like that to be able to. I would caution against that, but I would definitely say it could inspire us and say that in his readership, it could inspire an idea of subjecthood and difference between these windows, and kind of complementary nature of existence.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I'm going to ask the last question. Unfortunately, we don't have time for any more questions. There's a question. Asking about the term word literature. Mm-hmm. She believes that using the term word literature throws all the non-European cultures and cultural heritage into one big entity. The question is that could you elaborate on why you favor this term?
Well, that is such an important point. Yeah, we will have English and French and German, and in this corner, we're going to have the world literature, the rest. So kind of the West and the rest, which I absolutely sympathize with that. But I think you will go to the first step and the second step. And first, we have to make this literature heard and recognized. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, but it should be a step along the way. I very much would be for the, if we are going to have world literature, having a department of world literature when all kinds of different literatures are represented, not that some are represented and some are bunched together. And I absolutely sympathize with that, because it kind of irons out the difference between them. They're all there, they're after all the same thing, So absolutely not. But I value this being admitted into the group and making your way there, opening your space, and then from there going further. I don't think we should stop all the other efforts and only go this way. I think that with all the other efforts of translation, of having various disciplinary approaches to literature and be present in all of these places, but should definitely be recognized as a bona fide member of world literature that can give a lot to the world. And that's really the aspect that's important to me.
Thank you so much. Thank you. There were a lot of comments and other questions that we make sure that you receive them.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And then I can write answers and send to you, or I can refer to specific podcasts where I have discussed that for a half hour or something. So I'll be very happy to do that.
That would be wonderful. Thank you again. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Keshavarz, for joining us today for this fascinating lecture. It was definitely very enlightening, and based on the number of questions we received, that we can tell that everybody really enjoyed it, and they have a lot more that they want to talk about it. So we will share those questions with you. Special thanks to Dr. Janet Afari, Dr. Sombol Dale, and the entire team at UC Santa Barbara for helping organizing this incredible annual lecture series in collaboration with Farhang Foundation. I also shared Dr. Keshavarz's podcast, Radio Rumi, in the chat, so you can access it and register for it and start enjoying it. As always, please visit farhang.org for all our latest upcoming events, talks, and programs. We thank you all for joining us from across the globe for today's live talk, and we look forward to welcoming you to the next lecture. Until then, we bid you farewell. Thank you, Dr. Keshavarz. Thank you, Dr. Somboldet.
Thank you to you all for organizing this. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Goodbye and farewell for now.